unless you shut down the altered metabolism and switched off the inflammation. Moreover, how had cancer started? Had researchers and orthodox doctors lost sight of the bigger picture? I lay there thinking about how the cancer cell was different to a normal cell. It had been reprogrammed to endlessly divide and make two daughter cells, and to do this, it used huge amounts of nutrients. On a very basic level, cells are made up of various proteins, enzymes, organelles, nucleic acids, etc., encapsulated by a fatty membrane. Each cancer cell would need both the fat required for new cell membranes as well as protein for building new internal cell structures. Like building a house, you need a workforce, the energy to build it, and bricks and mortar. With cancer, the main energy source seemed to be glucose, but it needed access to fat and protein too to build its cell structure. The process was essentially the same no matter what type of cancer it was, pancreatic, lymphoma, or breast. Starving these cells of fat and the protein it needed was surely important, as well as blocking the glucose it used for the cell division. Did that mean a starvation diet might work? But even when patients had cachexia, when the body began wasting away, the cancer often continued to thrive, stealing nutrients from other parts of the body. It certainly seemed to be a systemic problem affecting the whole person, not just a zone or specific area in the body. I gleaned information from every doctor I saw and as many journals as I could find. I continued to modify my diet. A description of my approach would probably be a low-glycemic, low-inflammatory, high-fiber, mostly pescatarian paleo diet, but low in saturated fat. In other words, the caveman diet. I had cut out potatoes, aubergines, tomatoes, rhubarb, strawberries, and all citrus foods. Grapefruit was the worst, all too acidic or inflammatory for me. I ate no dairy apart from a little parmesan as a treat, and occasionally a little bioactive yogurt. It was more about how my body was able to digest the food, the glycemic index, and how it reacted to different food types. If I bloated after a meal, then I must have triggered an inflammatory reaction in my gut, and inflammation needed to be avoided at all costs. Meals were no longer a source of comfort, as they had been in the past, and cooking was an added burden to my already jam-packed day, so my meals were very basic. Simple salads with a bit of short grain brown rice doused with olive oil at lunchtimes. I wondered if this intense level of commitment was necessary. There was really no way of knowing, but when I remembered the statistics, I knew I had little choice. I would never be able to return to my pre-cancer diet. If cancer needed both fat and protein for creating two identical new progenies, as well as glucose for energy to create them, then starving the cancer was going to be tricky. I needed to cut all three food sources, the macros in my diet, fat, carb, and protein, and just starving myself might kill me in the process. It didn't seem to be a long-term solution. I wondered if there were some foods I could eat safely that cancer didn't like. Cutting back on volume came first. The benefits of caloric restriction for cancer were reported as early as 1914 by Peyton Rouse, who also discovered that viruses could trigger the disease. His work on a viral cause for cancer was not given proper recognition until much later. He was finally awarded a Nobel Prize in 1966. Still, no one has yet acknowledged his observations on diet restriction in mice, or his suggestion that it could be useful for many cancers. The effects of underfeeding gained attention again in 1940, but it lost momentum with the advent of chemotherapy and the scramble for new game changers. The latest drugs were allegedly magic bullets. A reduction in volume seemed obvious to me, even without sight of this research. I gradually ate smaller and smaller portions. Perhaps this alone would be enough to tip the balance, weaken the cancer, and allow my immune system to regain the upper hand. Reducing protein was relatively easy, but were beans and lentils a healthier substitute? I couldn't be sure. In my quest to lower fat and simple carbohydrates, several supplements piqued my interest. Gymnema sylvestre is an Indian Ayurvedic herb, and a trial on diabetic patients, type 1 and 2, showed it reduced glucose. It also seemed to raise insulin levels, which might make it a risk. Perhaps it made insulin work more efficiently in the body. I was still taking Mahonia aquifolium tincture, but no one else had written about berberine, the main constituent of Mahonia aquifolium for cancer. There was no trace of it in any of the literature. If no one was using berberine for cancer, maybe I was wrong. Perhaps it wasn't as good as I thought. In 2002, I decided to swap berberine and try Gymnema instead, as the article on Mahonia, which had mentioned its anti-tumorial, antimicrobial, anti-inflammatory as well as glucose-lowering effects, in the 1999 Journal of Herbal Medicine was fading from my memory, crowded out by the clutter of additional information. This swap was a mistake in hindsight. The combination may have been much better. Hydroxycitrate from a plant called Garcinia cambogia, found in India, was able to modify and reduce fat in the body. My instincts were fortunately correct, as I later discovered this compound could block ATP citrate lyase, which converts the excess pyruvate produced by cancer cells into fatty acids for making new cell membranes. But would it then just push the cancer to use more glycolytic or other fat-driven metabolic pathways? Research relating to cancer was non-existent for both Gymnema and hydroxycitrate. It was all about diabetes and weight loss. But in they went into my cancer-starving regime. Blocking each cancer fuel supply was imperative. But how many were there? Was I blocking enough? Chromium picolinate was shown to improve insulin sensitivity and improve glycemic control, so perhaps it would make the Gymnema work better and reduce the insulin. Taking the two together might work synergistically. Sure enough, a later review of both treatments by physician Richard Nahas in 2009 showed that both Gymnema and chromium picolinate to be effective for glycemic control. Niacin B3, this precursor of the coenzyme NAD, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, had fat-reducing properties too. It also has a beneficial effect on insulin, although the mechanism for this is less clear. NAD is important in not just the breakdown of fat, but also carbohydrate, protein, and alcohol breakdown and storage, as well as cell signaling and DNA repair. It may be very useful in the post-treatment period as well, when the body needs to rebuild cells with normal mitochondrial function. Dr. Kalibu, my integrative doctor, prescribed a no-flush version. A higher caloric intake is associated with more aggressive and worse survival cancer rates. But was this a result of too much sugar, too much fat, too much protein, or just too much of everything? Omega-6 oils promoted cancer growth. This was very clear. I completely avoided sunflower oil and other processed vegetable oils, as they made inflammation worse. In contrast, the Mediterranean diet had a much lower incidence of cancer. Perhaps olive oil was a safe fat to use despite containing omega-6. Its high omega-9 content, I learned, neutralized the omega-6. Butter I used sparingly, even though it contained the vitamins A, D, and K, and something called conjugated linoleic acid, CLA. CLA was reported to have huge beneficial effects for both prevention and treatment of cancer. Many natural substances contain this fatty acid, butter, cheese, saturated fat in red meat. But I wanted to avoid saturated fat, so taking a supplement was the safer option. It was the omega-7 part of CLA, the palmitoleic acid, which I have since discovered was the beneficial part, not to be confused with palmitic acid, a bad oil, although this can be neutralized by omega-9. Palmitoleic acid can be found in both olive oil and sea buckthorn oil, and the most beneficial part of palmitoleic oil is vaccenic, also known as rumenic, acid, a natural trans fat. This has beneficial effects on high blood sugar, elevated lipid levels, inflammation and excess fat gain, and it enhances insulin sensitivity. It is a super nutrient. Instead of taking CLA as a supplement, as I did in those days, I now take a daily sea buckthorn oil capsule, which contains omega-7. But it only really works efficiently in the presence of bifidobacteria in the gut. Hence the need for checking your gut has adequate amounts and no dysbiosis or abnormal levels of pathogenic bacteria. For metabolic health, I believe everyone should include omega-7 alongside adequate omega-3, fish oils, and omega-9 to help prevent all the major metabolic diseases, Alzheimer's, cancer, stroke, metabolic syndrome, and heart disease. As a follower of both medical trends and the latest trends in cosmetics and toiletries, I always see the cosmetics industry taking on board these beneficial nutrients much faster. Sea buckthorn oil has been big news for a while in toiletries, and yet is still virtually unheard of as a supplement. It should be big news in cancer and cardiovascular treatment too. Periodically, Dr. Calibou reviewed my supplements, and to my horror, he would prescribe yet more. He prescribed vitamin K3 and Mataki D fraction, a mushroom extract, both shown to boost immunity and enhance the effects of intravenous vitamin C. He also prescribed DHEA, not recommended for hormone-related cancers, which enhanced my well-being and immunity, and it also starves cancer by blocking the pentose phosphate pathway, part of the process of building new DNA molecules. All cancer patients researching their disease will come across articles that link cancer to sugar, poor diets, or lifestyle habits. The result is that on top of feeling unwell, there is an unspoken sense of guilt and shame that somehow you had played a part in causing your illness. This may not, in fact, be the case. Despite reports that lifestyle and environmental factors like pathogens and carcinogens are thought to be up to 90% responsible for cancer, avoiding pathogens can be impossible unless you live like a hermit at the North Pole. Parasites, bacteria, and fungi are all linked, as well as the well-known association of viruses. Many viruses are linked to cancer, such as Epstein-Barr, HPV, hepatitis B and C, CMV, human T lymphotropic virus, Kaposi sarcoma-associated herpes virus, KSHV, and Merkel cell polyomavirus. More are being discovered as scientists actively search for a link. The bovine leukemia virus was added in 2015 as a risk for breast cancer, a virus highly prevalent in milk worldwide. I suspect many more cancers will be linked to viruses in the future. Many people eat appalling diets and have shocking lifestyles yet remain immune to cancer, while vegans who pride themselves on their healthy lifestyle can be afflicted too. But the media propagates this blame culture. This victimization of the patient is unwelcome and unhelpful baggage. Those with the disease stoically submit themselves to tortuous and barbaric treatments with little complaint, a punishment they feel they deserve for failing to be a paragon of health before. With cancer, shouldn't you expect to suffer horribly to get well? If a medical treatment doesn't make you feel violent,